everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the Horrid Halls of Academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subasati.
And we are back for another year. It is 2019.
Oh my God.
How do you feel about that, Andrea?
I'm not sure. Good, I guess. Well, I guess not feeling anything about it is a good sign, as long as it's not bad. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I just felt like 2018 just wouldn't stop.
It was pretty relentless.
It went
yeah.
quick, but it just, there was so much. So
yeah,
that's why we do these episodes, guys, to look back, to assess.
Yes. Yes. I look forward to this episode. I enjoy it. And there was a lot of great movies out this year. Is it the best year for horror movies? Was it the worst year for horror movies? We don't care. We like to look at the good and the important, and we'll talk about it. And I don't know. I saw some good fucking films.
Yeah, I saw a couple good films, too. I realized I don't have nearly as many as I did last year.
Is that right?
Yeah, but the films I'm going to mention today, I feel very strongly
Same.
About. And if you don't like them, that's totally cool, as always. But if I was sitting having a coffee or a beer with you, listener, these are the films from this year I'd tell you to go see.
Yeah, so we're going to start with those before we move along to some frequently asked questions and some fun. We'll have the bloopers, as per custom. I feel like there's less and less of those every single year.
It's because we're so damn good.
I think it's just that, like, we fuck up hilariously less, but we dick around more, so they're more like outtakes than bloopers, but I think they're still fun.
And then we've got a game, sort of, that we've invented.
Alex invented.
I invented. But we're going to give that a shot, and we'll see how that goes. So, who knows?
Okay, so, do you want to begin?
Yeah, let's start off. So, these are our favorite films of 2018. We each made lists independently of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very excited to hear what you have to say, Andrea. Should we start with, like, our most favorite of 2018?
Yeah, let's do that. I didn't list them in my notes that way, but I think I can safely say what mine was.
Yeah.
Suspiria.
That was mine too!
How did I know that?
Twinsies!
Yeah. Total twinsies, because not only did we both love it, we saw it together.
Mm-hmm.
I think we saw the look of shock and awe in each other's eyes as the credits rolled.
Yeah.
And I think we're really on the same page with regard to how we feel about the original.
Mm-hmm.
And how this remake, reboot, really brought this story into my heart, whereas the original did not do that.
Yeah, and we still love the original film. They're just such different beasts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to pat myself on the back because it was this episode back in 2016 that I talk about how excited I am for Luca Guadagnino's remake of Suspiria.
2016?
2016 when they
Holy
announced
shit.
It.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I like this director. I like this cast.
Uh-huh.
I'm super into it. And the thing is it to say this film answers questions is odd, but for me, what I always loved about the original Suspiria is like the visual style and the kind of absurd nature of it. What I always found lacking in it, it didn't hinder my enjoyment of it, but it was the setting of it. And I thought the setting was so interesting. It's Germany. It's 1977, seemingly. It seems to be taking place during a contemporary period.
Mm-hmm.
And it's set in a dance school.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are so prevalent. And, you know, if you're a dancer, you know what that feels like. Germany in the 70s, that's a huge story. So I was very excited to see a film that really investigated those themes, those ideas, as well as so many others.
Mm-hmm. Yes, not only the backdrop of the setting and the time of year and the tumultuous political stuff going on in the background, I just really appreciated the in-depth looks at the main characters and at the witches, man.
Mm-hmm.
Like, watching the original Suspiria, I feel the male gaze. I feel it in that these are just kind of whispering girls who want to be dancers, and then these are bad witches who want to be bad witches. Whereas in this remake, we've got heart and soul, and it really peeks behind the curtain, and it was really, really rewarding to see all that. I don't think it was a perfect film. I think there was some really questionable prosthetic work. I think it was overlong, and I even feel like I can remember scenes that I would have cut had it been me. Somebody told me before I saw it, somebody mentioned Rob Zombie in reference to the film. And I think I brought it up to you. We were having dinner before the screening. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm really curious about that. And I get it. I get it. Because there's just a couple of lines that are so in my view, needlessly crude and shocking that I was just kind of like, man, that kind of talk is beneath this. But at the same time, you know, where would we be without the errant F-bomb in the Faculty of Horror?
Yeah, you guys love that show.
Okay, your turn.
All right. So I'm now kind of going in no particular order.
Uh-huh.
This next film is one that you actually turned me on to, Andrea.
Uh-huh.
And that's a little film called Pie Wacket.
Oh, did we not talk about that last year?
No, I saw it this year.
Ah, shit. Okay, I feel like I saw it last year, so I didn't put it on my list, but holy fuck. That's one of my favorite films of the last decade.
Yeah. Andrea recommended it to me and our friend Allison Lang, author of Women with Guts, when we were out drinking one night.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like the next day I was like, ooh, I could do with a good freaky film.
Mm-hmm.
I went and I found it and I rented it and I watched it and it scared me so much that my partner works as a bartender. He was bartending until like midnight and I just stayed up for him to get home because the final like third or whatever that was of that film, it just unsettled me. I just felt like, ugh, I don't even like to think about it, but it was so good.
So that film came to me, well, it came to Rue Morgue through a press release, this new film that's coming out, and I assigned it to a writer, and I remember the writer's review was overall very positive, and he likened it to The Craft. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. But then when I saw it, and just to give you guys a little preamble, this is kind of it's a witchcraft story, and it's a story about a teenager who is feeling very powerless and is in a situation where she's feeling very powerless. And so she kind of turns to the dark arts, and things go very awry. And so it has that in common with The Craft, but I also thought the creature design was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I never get to say that. So I'm happy to scream it from the rooftop.
And, you know, it's an excellent example of a male director. This was directed by a guy, Canadian. It's a Canadian film. Hey-ho. By a guy named Adam McDonald. And I think he's actually local to Toronto. But he created a really vivid portrait of what it feels like to be a teenage girl.
Yeah.
It felt very authentic. It felt very honest. It felt messy and strange. But I really liked all the characters.
Me too.
And that's a theme that kind of kept coming up for me this year as I watched horror films was, do I like these people? And do if it's a life or death situation, do I want them to survive?
That's right.
And I genuinely cared about several of these characters.
I feel like that's standard criteria for general film criticism, but it's one that often gets overshadowed in horror in favor of where the scare's good, special effects, like this and this and that, but Pie Wacket ticks off all those boxes.
Yeah.
Good one, good one.
Thank you.
I would like to give an honorable mention to The Ritual, which, I think it came out kind of on the heels of 2018. Some people saw it early. I didn't see it early. I saw it when it came out on Netflix and exploded with all this buzz. Once again, really interesting monster, really well conceived visually. There were times that I wanted more from it, but not in a I'm not satisfied kind of way, but kind of hope for a sequel.
Oh.
Do you like that one?
Not really.
Not at all?
No. It just felt a bit muddled to me. I couldn't kind of get at what the core of it was.
Mm.
And I think I left it kind of being a bit more frustrated than anything else. But I will agree with you. The creature design was pretty cool.
The creature looked great. And I don't know. I want to talk about it more, but there's spoilers to be had. Maybe it'll be an episode one day. Maybe not.
Yeah, maybe.
A really interesting observation I heard about the film was, it's just a guy version of The Descent in the woods instead of a cave. And I could see that, but I don't consider that a weakness.
And for me, it actually reminded me a lot of the Ben Wheatley film Kill List, which I wasn't the biggest fan of either. But it's, you know, it's got its audience. It's got its thing.
It does. People love it. And so I checked it out. But hilariously, I had a hard time understanding it. I think I've admitted on this podcast that I struggle with accents a bit, that I watch the entirety of The Wire with subtitles on because they're speaking fucking English, but apparently I don't speak Baltimore. I need to go back to Kill List.
Am I next?
Yeah, your turn.
All right. So this is a film that came out earlier on this year and had a very strange release, a very fucked up release, but it, I think, has very deservedly found an audience, maybe a cult audience, but I'm very happy it has. And that would be Alex Garland's Annihilation.
Okay.
I thought it was excellent. I thought it was really brave. I thought it was strange. I loved a lot of all of the performances, and it just took me to places where I didn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
And it chilled me. Very, very impressed by it.
Cool.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. The first time I saw it, I was really baffled at the end, and I was like, oh, okay, you know, I've enjoyed this all the way through. I'm really intrigued. I'm really invested. I need to let this sit with me, and maybe that ending will kind of crystallize. Mm-hmm. And it never did. And so I went back to it semi-recently. I think it was early December. I went back to it and watched it again, and I was like, no, I still don't get it. And I do remember the production history mm-hmm. of this film, which is to say that Alex Garland was told he was given full creative freedom. He shot an ending the way he did. The studio didn't like it, and he stuck to his guns. And the studio said, if you stick to your ending, we're not going to release it theatrically.
Or very limitedly.
In the UK, yes. Which was his native country. And so that was really crushing. But he stuck to his guns, and the ending is what I struggle with. So part of me is almost like, fuck, I wish there was kind of a producer's cut, so to speak. I might have liked it more.
Yeah, it also, not to say, like, this film always reminds me of this film. I mean this respectfully for the films I'm talking about today, but Annihilation definitely had a kind of under-the-skin vibe.
Mm-hmm.
Another movie I absolutely loved.
Yes.
So,
I have been on a waiting list for about a year to check out the audiobook. They have, like, 2 copies at the Toronto Public Library, and I'm only number 375th in line or something. So I'm really hoping to check it out, and maybe that'll reconcile some of the problems I had with it.
Well, dream big, Andrea.
Yeah, maybe not.
But it's part of the novel. It's part of a trilogy.
Yes. And so if they continue the trilogy cinematically,
probably
I don't know if they
not.
Will. Definitely not with Alex Garland. And who knows if Natalie Portman will. She seems like a very principled individual, so she might not come back. But we'll see.
Yeah, and that fucking bear skull monster thing with the scream. Oh,
I agree. The creatures were terrifying, and the concept was very chilling.
Yeah, yeah.
Next on my list, another little Canadian gem, as far as I'm concerned, is Summer of 84. And this was a film that, again, crossed my desk as, you know, here's a little Canadian gem that maybe your little Canadian gem of a magazine would like to cover. And I watched it and I was like, hell to the fuck, yeah, I will. So this film was made by RKSS, who are a filmmaking collective out of Montreal. And there's 3 of them. I believe there's like a brother and a sister and then the sister's partner or something. So kind of keeping it in the family, kind of a family affair. And they are the trio behind Turbo Kid, which I still haven't seen. But I remember when it came out, people were like, it's very creative. It's very ambitious. It's not perfect. But what's RKSS going to come out with next? And this is it. And what it is it's a story. It's set in the 1980s. And it's a story of a couple of teenage guys who suspect that the rash of serial killings happening in their sleepy suburban neighborhood are, they think they know who it is, and so they set out to investigate this person. And so twists and turns abound, and it has a very, obviously, a Stranger Things feel to it. Mm. That's a criticism that I've seen leveraged at it, was that it's kind of aping off the 80s nostalgia thing, but I thought it was great, and I especially dug the ending, which left me with a lot of dread. Did you see it?
No, I didn't. And I thought it was because you didn't like it.
Oh.
I could have sworn you told me you saw it and didn't like it.
I gave it a feature in the Meg.
I know.
That's wild.
Yeah, I didn't put this other film on my list. I will now try to track down Summer of 84 because that sounds really interesting. But another film I watched, which didn't wind up on my best of list, but mm-hmm. I do want to give it a shout out for just an incredible performance,
yeah.
is The Clove Hitch Killer.
Mm.
Dylan McDermott, some of you may know him as the very hot, sexy, aesthetically pleasing husband from the first season of American Horror Story, Murder House.
Mm-hmm.
He is, without doing too much, he's unrecognizable, and I thought he was excellent in
is that
the film.
Right?
And the film is pretty good,
mm-hmm.
but it reminds me, it's this kind of 80s serial killer, the kids are on to something kind of thing. And
okay.
There's a lot of good performances in that film, but Dylan McDermott really blew me away in this film.
Cool. Well, there's one to add to my list. I know we reviewed it in the magazine, and I think the reviewer gave it kind of a, that's fine.
Mm. It's worth checking out. It's not my favorite, but it's worth checking out.
Honorable mention's good enough for me.
There's a couple very, like, interesting moments in
okay,
it.
Okay, okay.
The next on my list, which I'm pretty sure is going to be on your list, Andrea, is Assassination Nation.
God damn it. That film is breaking my heart. Just because I saw it early and I was like, I have heard no buzz about this. I don't know this Sam Levinson guy from Boo. And it blew me away so hard. I was so excited for it to come out. I thought it would make such a splash. I thought everybody would be talking about it. And goddamn, if I didn't do my damnedest, I put it in the magazine with a huge splash feature. I got a really great interview out of Sam Levinson, or so I thought. I think that's one of the better pieces I've written for Rumorg. And I'm retweeting and I'm banging this movie's drum, but I feel like nobody's talking about it.
Yeah, you clued me into it right after you saw it. I remember I came here to record one day and I had to sit in your living room and wait while you did the interview with Sam Levinson.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But then because we were both pressed for TIFF this year, I got to see it at TIFF when it screened there to a really packed audience, and the audience, certainly seemingly all around me, had a blast watching it.
Oh, good.
I went to see it with my partner, Danny. He really enjoyed it, and it just felt like this really aggressive breath of fresh air. You know what I have to say? I'm not shocked it didn't make a big splash. My gut says it's going to become one of those things that kind of like simmers over time, and then it will be like, oh yes, this cult film, Assassination Nation.
I truly hope so, because I did an interview just this afternoon about kind of trends happening in horror right now, trends. And I think addressing the role of social media in our lives is a trend that I really embrace, because it is such a big part of our lives. And I feel like filmmakers don't know how to do it. And rightfully so. It's a huge challenge. And this film just puts it right in your face. It puts everything right in your fucking face. If you're not familiar with what the film is about, it takes place in Salem, in present-day Salem, where a privacy hack reveals everyone's dirty laundry, from their text message history to their browser history to everything. And the city just goes on, for lack of a better term, a witch hunt. And of course, what happens in a witch hunt but the most disenfranchised population gets it? And in this case, it's a couple of teenage girls. And yeah, I love this film. I rewatched it with Dustin last month, and I still really love this film. So yeah. If you haven't checked it out, I highly recommend it. And give Sam Levinson some love, so goddamn, he makes more films. Okay, my turn?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I would be remiss. I know this isn't one of your favorites of the year, but Hereditary, guys. Hereditary.
Sorry, I haven't heard of this one. Is it?
So, once more, I saw this film. Elevation got a hold of me, and they were like, this film's going to be a big deal. Come see it in a private cinema at, like, fucking 9 a.m. And this is a really weird film to watch in a private cinema at 9 a.m. and then come out in broad daylight and look at life. And, yeah, it really, really weirded me out. It affected me very deeply in ways that I'm still largely unpacking. Once again, if you're not familiar with the concept, this is a film that deals with a family torn apart by grief, and then some supernatural stuff comes in later, and I feel like that's enough to say about the plot. I think what chilled me about it was its portrayal of a household in shambles, and I know I've alluded to a not-so-happy upbringing on this podcast, and in reflecting on it, I feel like when you're growing up in a household, you don't have a whole lot of frame of reference as to whether or not your household is normal or happy or unhappy or functional or dysfunctional, right? You know snippets of your friends' lives that you see through slumber parties. You know, I don't know, I grew up in the era of like Full House and Family Matters. So I never really knew that what was going on in my household was bad or toxic or tense or anything like that until I grew up and I looked back on it. And I have never seen a household so akin to my own as I did in Hereditary. And I realize how fucked up that might sound for those of you who have seen it. But those dinner table blowouts were quite commonplace, and it was really validating to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of Hereditary. It definitely like felt like I got hit over the head when I saw it, and I wasn't sure how I felt about it. I will say the thing I find most interesting about it, and I do want to go back and kind of rewatch it and just see how I feel again, and I'm sure we will do it on an upcoming episode for everyone asking. So the more I thought about this film, the less I liked it. And I think that was just because these kind of strange character decisions just didn't make sense to me, and they felt a bit lazy. But again, what is interesting to me about the film is, as Andrea was saying, it really nailed some of the things that I think are the hardest to do in film. And it for me and me only, yeah. No one out there on the internet is going to change my fucking mind about this, it shit the bed in a lot of things where it should have exceeded. Mm. As Andrea was mentioning, that dinner table scene, there might be several in the film, but there's a really specific one that I'm thinking of, and you and I, Andrea, have talked about this, that feels so scary and so tense, and it is so upsetting. And I've definitely been in those situations in my childhood, and I saw it on screen. Mm-hmm. And that just felt like a true gut punch, mm-hmm. you know, but it just didn't get me. And I wanted to get it. It just didn't get me.
It happens.
Doesn't mean it's a bad film for everyone. Just nope. Didn't work for me.
Okay.
So I've got one more on my list before I get into some horror adjacent things.
Okay.
So we'll do this one and then Andrea can finish off her list and we'll talk about those. So this one was one I saw kind of late in the year. But again, this was Andrea, you saw it. You seem kind of buzzed on it, so I checked it out. And that was Cam.
Oh, yes. Fuck. I didn't put that on my list, but I loved it.
Yeah.
Why didn't I put it on there?
I don't know, man. That's why we're still together. Yin and yang. Cam was just a really interesting experience. Mm-hmm. Again, it was very high concept in a lot of ways. And it's about a cam girl, mm-hmm. a girl who does kind of weird kinky stuff online mm-hmm. for money. And she wants to kind of achieve a certain status in this cam girl room setup that she has. And she does it, but at this strange cost when things start turning around on her and becoming very weird. And this seemingly strange entity seems to be taking over her persona online.
Yeah.
And for something being so high concept,
yeah.
it was very clearly executed. And the ending, I thought, was really interesting because the ending chose to privilege a character's ending over a logic ending in a certain way.
Okay.
Which I thought was actually quite interesting.
Huh.
And it didn't anger me. It didn't upset me. I enjoyed it so much that I liked that it took a bit of a different turn from
right.
where I expected it to
yeah,
go.
Yeah, yeah. No, I had some preconceived notions going into it because I knew what it was about, and I thought it dealt with her ambition of being a successful cam person really beautifully. You know, mm-hmm. this is sex work, but it didn't present that in a it was never ever titillating. Like, yeah, you're going to see some yeah. boobies, but it's not presented in a titillating way. Like, you're with this chick 100%,
yeah.
and the stigma, and that's a very valid career path in this day and age, and people do create personas online in so many ways, and I really liked the way it was tackled. It reminded me a lot of an anime movie I saw ages ago called Perfect Blue, which I think would be an amazing pairing for an episode.
Yeah.
So you guys tell us if you'd be into that. Okay, well, I have a couple of films on my list that I juried for a film fest this year, I think. Is it the first time I've done that? It's the first time in a while that I've done that. And it was for Grimfest, which is in the UK. So everything was screeners. And as in typical Andrea fashion, I didn't used to be this way, but this is how I am now. I leave everything to the last minute and I cram. I don't like it, but I'm getting really good at it, so I'm probably not going to change. But as a result, I had screeners and screeners and screeners of amazing movies that I just hammered down over the course of like 2 weeks. And I have a couple of standouts from Grimm's selection that
Let's
I would like
hear
to bring
them.
Up. One of them is Tigers Are Not Afraid.
And you want to see that.
Probably heard about it because it is being so universally celebrated and the hype is real. If you love, as we love, old Guillermo del Toro, his Spanish language films that posit a beautiful semi-supernatural story amid cultural and political ruin that involve heartwarming children dealing with subjects that are way beyond what any child should have to deal with. It was really beautiful and touching and moving and in many cases scary, directed by a woman who is apparently working with Guillermo del Toro on her next project.
Very cool.
Yeah, Issa Lopez, she's going to be a big deal, and so see the film. And another selection, this one was such an oddball in that lineup. It's called Satan's Slaves.
Yes, I saw it's on Shudder right now.
Is it really?
Yes.
Okay, well,
that's
great news because sometimes with these festival films, I don't want to run them too hard in the magazine because if people can't get a hold of them, I don't want to tease and titillate you with movies that you can't find. But I really loved it. I was culturally a bit mind freaked at the fact that this is an obviously like kind of an Asian population, but it's also very Muslim. It's an Indonesian horror film, and that's a culture that I don't know very well. And so this was Obviously, horror movies are such a great way to understand a culture by looking at what it is they fear. So without giving too much away, this is a family coping with the death of the matriarch and a deal that the matriarch may have made before she died. Is that fair to tease?
Yeah. No, it definitely doesn't sound like Hereditary that way.
No, actually, yeah. I hadn't made that connection,
no,
but totally.
Yeah, no, I saw it, and I definitely was getting some Hereditary kind of vibes from it.
Okay.
Different, like totally different, but thematically there's
thematically, absolutely. However, this was jump scares that I didn't hate.
Great jump scares.
Right?
Yeah.
Scared the crap out of me, so that one was great. And another film that I would like to mention for its virtuous jump scares is Terrified. It's an Argentinian film. It's called Aterrados, translated to Terrified. And this is a film that we're really unlikely to see covered in Faculty of Horror because
well, story-wise, Shudder too.
It is, yeah. Yeah, again, so check that out there. But yeah, story-wise, it left me a little bit cold. It had these kind of... It was almost an anthology horror.
Yeah.
I'd say.
That didn't resolve anything.
That didn't resolve anything, but the journey to get there scared the shit out of me so many times. And you know when you think that you're so seasoned as a horror fan, you know when you think you can see a jump scare coming a mile away, this movie just wiped my slate clean.
Yeah, and it went right over my head.
No, you didn't like it?
Didn't like it.
Didn't scare
you?
No,
it a couple of moments where I went, ugh,
yeah.
But it didn't stay with me.
Okay.
And Satan's Slaves, I enjoyed it. I just felt like it was too long.
Mm.
It just went a bit too long for me. And
okay.
it just kind of lost me in the end. But definitely both those films worth your time to check out. Feel like a good, like, creepy film.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and I just love, like, fresh international stuff, man.
Yeah.
That's cool to say at the end of the year.
Yeah. So I have a couple horror-adjacent things I wanted to mention.
Okay.
Give a shout-out to that I think that, Andrea, if you haven't seen them, listeners, if you haven't seen them, you might really dig. They're not quite horror, but I really enjoyed them. And they were creepy, and they were weird, or they had some kind of element to them that I think our listeners, or you, Andrea, might enjoy.
Okay.
So the first one is a film called Border, and it was directed by Ali Abbasi, and it's actually based on a short story by John Avjid Lindqvist. And
that rings a bell.
Yeah, does it ring a bell through my butchered pronunciation? That's the guy who wrote the original book of Let the Right One In.
Oh.
So if you liked Let the Right One In,
I
would highly recommend Border.
Oh.
It's a Scandi film. It's beautiful and strange and really good performances. And I heard about it when it was playing at TIFF, and I didn't get to see it there. But then it had a very limited theatrical run in Toronto, so I got to see it. And what I basically heard from everyone was the less you know going in, the better.
Oh, okay.
So
one of those.
Go. It should be on VOD or something very soon if it's not already. But Border, check it out. Let us know what you think. It's a very, very interesting film and picks up on some of the stranger elements of Let the Right One In.
Okay, but you're identifying it as horror adjacent because it's not quite...
I wouldn't call it horror.
More of a drama?
I almost don't want to say.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't want to
really,
say.
Really, the less you know, the better.
Seriously, the less you know, the better. But it was quite a lovely film.
Okay.
And very interesting, and I'm still kind of turning it over in my head.
Nice.
Another film I want to talk about is a film by written directed by a former musician by the name of Boots Riley, and it's a film called Sorry to Bother You.
Mm.
And it is excellent.
Mm.
And I've heard it referred to as this in a couple other places, but it is a bit of a Shaggy Dog film. There's a couple moments that are a bit it's got a lot to it.
Okay.
But it is so excellent and brave and funny and dark and strange. And it stars certainly now one of my favorite people, Lakeith Stanfield, who you may remember as the guy from the beginning of Get Out, who then says the titular Get Out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he's the lead in this film.
Cool.
Tessa Thompson is kind of the female lead in this film. There's
yeah.
a lot of great people in it. And it's so strange and it's so funny and it's so weird.
Cool.
And it's dark, and it's like, fuck you, capitalism.
Sick.
It's great. and a final shout-out I want to give.
Do it.
In terms of a film that's horror-adjacent is super horror-adjacent, kind of, is Bandersnatch.
Wow.
The Black Mirror, I guess, kind of holiday episode that they released on Netflix.
Uh-huh.
I really enjoyed it. I was very impressed by it.
In what way?
The story is pretty straightforward in some ways, but I thought the technology that they used to create this kind of choose-your-own-adventure thing was really well done.
Yeah.
And I used to love choose-your-own-adventure books when I was a kid, so it definitely had a lot of that. And it really kind of – certainly the journeys I've taken with it, it's played with the audience in really fun ways. And I thought it was really well done. And if you haven't done it and you have Netflix, give it a shot. It's pretty fun. And Danny and I went to our friend's house during the holidays – and we all did it together, and we actually had a blast doing it.
Okay. It left me cold. I was, I'm a big fan of Black Mirror, bigger than Alex, I thought, even.
I really like Black Mirror. The thing is, it depresses the fuck out
of
me.
Yeah,
so I've only seen some of them.
Yeah, okay.
I haven't
seen
all of them, but I think it's great.
I love it. And so the idea of a choose your own adventure, and I knew that Netflix was doing interactive stuff like this. I had played the Minecraft one before, and so I was like, oh, you know, we're going to do this in horror. And I had some problems with it, and I engaged in some Twitter conversations about it that sort of illuminated that maybe I missed what it was trying to do, but I also kind of feel like it missed what it was trying to do. But maybe we'll talk about it more one day.
Yeah. If you haven't checked it out, give it a shot. It's
pretty fun. Oh, yeah. It's worth it.
Yeah.
I don't have horror-adjacent stuff. I didn't watch anything that wasn't horror.
Well, la-dee-da.
Just kidding. That's not true. I mean, I got into RuPaul's Drag Race. Mm-hmm. I'm rewatching The Office with my partner. I'm like, you know, still watching my Star Trek, my sci-fi stuff.
Well, what about this year? What about 2019? What are some films you're excited for this year?
Nothing. No.
What? It's gonna be a shitty year for Rue Morgue.
No, that's
just
the kind
of blank covers.
Mm-mm, no, that's just the kind of detached objectivism that you want in your horror coverage. I don't know. I guess I'm getting grumpy because 2019 has started. I'm working on the March-April issue, and I'm like, somebody talk to me. This is the thing with this. Like, I have a dream job. I understand that, but I feel like people don't understand how fucking frustrating it is to really want to cover something and not be able to make deadline. Like, obviously, I'm so pumped for everything Jordan Peele is doing,
mm-hmm.
and he's up to a lot this year. There's a lot of shit coming down the pike. I'm pumped for all of it. And I'm sure Monkey Paw is, like, busting at the seams with press requests, but I just talk to me or else I won't be stoked anymore. I'll be sad.
So I'm also very excited for Us.
Us.
That's the new Jordan Peele film. I am so excited that I've stayed away from all of the trailers, everything I can. I've muted stuff online, so I don't see it, because my only real complaint with Get Out was that the trailer for it spoiled so much.
Mm-hmm.
But I still fucking love that movie.
Cool.
So I'm just trying to stay away from it so I can go in really fresh and I can, you know, do with it what I will.
Yep.
I'm also really excited for Happy Death Day to You.
Yeah, me too.
I loved the first one.
Me too.
It was so fun and refreshing and strange, but I really dug it. You know, I mentioned this on a couple other places. I'm also very excited for the new Pet Sematary remake.
Okay.
I really enjoyed Starry Eyes, which those two directors did before.
Uh-huh.
And I think the cast is really cool and I'm just very, very excited to see what they do with it.
You got a sneak peek, didn't you?
Oh, can I talk about that?
I think so. I think by the time this episode comes out, the issue... No, it won't be on stands.
No.
But we can talk about it.
I'll talk about it. I'm not going to say anything salacious, but I was very, very lucky to have enough vacation days, or a vacation day at my day job, to be able to go to Montreal and do a set visit to Pet Sematary while they were shooting this past summer just outside of Montreal. And it was awesome. It was so fucking cool. Because you're in this environment and you're in like rural Quebec, and I got to see the Pet Sematary, and it was, you know, you're out in the middle of nowhere Quebec, and you get driven in this golf cart down this fucking bumpy road, and then this Quebecois crew guy says, okay, now you get off down there to the Pet Sematary.
Pet Sematary.
And it was stunning. Is stunning. Mm-hmm. And like seeing the deadfall and the way they've constructed it and getting to interview so many people on set, including the directors and John Lithgow, was awesome. And I really think those two directors, Dennis and Kevin, if they get to make the film they really want to make, it's going to be fucking badass.
Yeah.
And okay, you can edit this out if it's too much.
All right.
But we were there all day me and a couple other press people, and we were at the craft service thing for dinner. We were talking to someone else, and I saw a guy in makeup, and as he slowly turned kind of his body just naturally towards me, I almost threw up. And that person was playing Victor Pascal.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And it was so fucking gross.
He was pretty fucking gross in the original, man.
But this is, I'm not, gore doesn't get to me.
Yeah.
But this, like,
You didn't see Zelda, did you?
No, okay. No, I did not.
I was almost scared to send you on that.
Literally, the publicist from Paramount was like, guys, we've got the people. Like, they're going to come. And she was so excited that I literally, in, like, my mind, in the reptile part of my brain was like, Alex, they're bringing out Zelda. If they bring out Zelda, you have to fucking run. And it wasn't. It was the directors. And they were lovely and so
nice. Guys.
But I was, like, fully prepared to fucking book it into a field in Quebec.
Bless your heart, Paramount.
But I'm very excited for that. Also very excited for Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which is directed by Andre Overdahl, who did Autopsy of Jane Doe and Troll
we
Hunter.
Love.
Also, I feel like this one might upset you.
No, it won't.
Okay. It is a Grudge remake.
Woo!
But this one is directed by Nicholas Pesci. I'm pronouncing that wrong, I'm sure. But I'm very excited because he also directed one of my kind of favorite recent horror films, which is called The Eyes of My Mother, which is very dark and very strange. And I loved it. So I think that could be really cool. I'm also kind of excited for It Chapter 2.
I'm interested.
Yeah, interested may be the better word.
Yeah.
Just because I actually haven't read the novel, but from everything I've heard from you, Andrea, from my partner who loves Stephen King, is that it is fucking bonkers.
It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough to render that on screen. And I have to say that the first film, I rewatched it and it doesn't, I'm not,
Not sold on it?
No. I think the first time I saw it, I was just like, wow, I didn't loathe it. I didn't want to walk out.
No.
What a treat. And I was really excited. And then when I rewatched it, I was like, it's not good. So yeah, cautiously optimistic. I'm open to it, I guess.
I'll definitely go see it in theaters just because I'm so curious.
Yeah.
And my final film that I know about for right now, 2019, that I'm excited for, is a film that I did not get to see at TIFF. I tried.
A Star is Born.
Yes. Oh, God.
You did see that.
No human has ever desired to be liked more than Bradley Cooper.
Failing.
Ugh. No, it is a film called In Fabric. By Peter Strickland.
Yeah. I'm dying for that to come out so I can cover it. I haven't seen it, but what I've heard sounds fascinating.
Yeah. It's about, I think, a dress or something that's haunted and kind of passes through the hands of different people. If you've noticed, I like to stay away from as much press as possible before seeing a film, unless I cover it as press.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, gimme. Yeah. So those are the things that I'm pretty stoked to check out. But again, remember, guys, like this time last year-ish, no one was talking about Hereditary. It was when it premiered at Sundance and people were like, it's the new fucking Exorcist. And then everything blew open. So that's the exciting thing about horror. Anything can change at any time.
And because these movies are doing well, you know, these companies are going to take more chances on horror. And that's a good thing. I am excited for a couple of documentaries coming out in 2019. Horror Noir.
Oh,
I know you're pumped. I had heard a tinkling of this last summer. I wasn't sure when it was coming out, but I think we can talk about it now.
Yes.
Again, I'm also trying to get stuff for the magazine for that. So Horror Noir, you might have heard us mention, is a book that was written by Dr. Robin Armines Coleman, who is an academic. And I reached out to her about a piece last year, and she told me, she's like, I'm kind of out of the horror game. You know, like, obviously I saw Get Out, but like ever since I published that book, I haven't still been reading about and thinking about horror. Well, they made a documentary about that book, and behind it all are a very talented team, but among them is our own Ashley Blackwell from Graveyard Shift Sisters, who Alex and I adore, and we're really excited to check that out.
Yeah, I'm super excited for her.
And then there's the Nightmare on Elm Street 2 documentary, Scream Queens, which has been rumbled about and buzzed about for years and years.
Years.
I think like a successful Kickstarter years
yes,
ago.
Yes, and yes, and yes.
Yes. So that is, as far as I know, getting shopped around at film festivals mm-hmm. this year. So I'm fucking pumped.
Yeah. And Horror Noir is out in February on Shudder. So
that's right.
If you don't already have a Shudder subscription, it might be a good time to start that free trial with a RoomWorks code.
There you go. Use coupon code RoomWork.
One of the things I took to doing on social media was linking.
There you go.
There we go. There's a burp. First burp of 2018. There's a kind of snobbiness to the whole, like, straight to video.
Say snobbiness again. Just the second time that's come up in this episode. You guys liked that one, eh? That's nice.
No, that was in the pseudopod episode.
Oh, fuck me with a fork. I will cut that out as well as the fork bit because, wow. So our last question for this section comes from Amy Beddoes. If it's not too late. No. Amy Beddoes. Amy Beddoes. But John Carpenter wanted to stick to the source material, and he did. And it's an amazing, that's an informed thought.
So in the kind of intervening years between The Thing coming out and having a really rough go of it, and it becoming this beloved horror classic, cult classic, however you want to quantify it.
I didn't see that coming.
I didn't see it either. So we are back with a section of just frequently asked questions. We get questions from you guys throughout the year. We try to reply as much as possible. But we also think that this is a good time to kind of use our airwaves or your earwaves to talk to you guys directly about some of them and some of the questions we get asked the most often. When we put out a call for questions, these were the ones that kind of came up the most often. So, yeah. Let's dive in.
Yeah, let's do it. So the first one, these were compiled by Alex, who fields the majority of the emails directed at Faculty of Horror. Like she said, we don't always get to answer everything. We get a lot of comments and observations about the episodes that I love and I read and I think about. I don't always address, but we really do always look at all of them. But the first question we wanted to talk about is, and I'm asked this so much, mm-hmm. is how did you get into this industry? And what advice do you have for getting into this industry? And I think that's a really interesting question because I'm only just recognizing it as kind of an industry. Like, mm-hmm. God, I guess it's a thing. And I guess we're part of it now, 6 years deep into a podcast. And God damn it, I'm editor of RoomWorks. Somehow that happened.
Yeah,
I called it. Do you want to talk about your foray?
So getting into the industry for me, it kind of came out of doing my master's and my final paper, which I might have talked about before. I was doing a theater master's and I had a really great advisor and he encouraged me to delve into horror films based on the topic I wanted to talk about, which was violence in theater mm-hmm. and the portrayal of reality in violence in theater. And, you know, we started talking about like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and things like that. And so it just kind of guided me back to the things that I really loved when I was a kid about horror films, which I loved my whole life. And this book that I had on my shelf for years since I was a teenager called The Dread of Difference, mm-hmm. Which is a compilation of essays about gender in the modern horror film. And I loved writing that paper mm-hmm. and I just kind of wanted to write more about it. And I got more into horror blogging, which was really big at the time. This was like 8-9 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And so I got more into that. I started doing my own thing. And then I kind of felt enough confidence to approach mainly websites that I really admired at the time. And I was reading a lot and just saying like, hey, can I write for you? These are some ideas I have. And it was such a benefit to be living in Toronto at the time because yes. two major horror scenes that I can pick out that have a community are the Toronto scene and the LA scene. Mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of other ones that exist, but these two seem to come up the most often. Yeah. And I think it has a lot to do with film industries being in each city. And yeah, so I just started to find people. That's how I found Andrea. And that's, you know, how we kind of got into it. And it's slow and it's steady. And not only does it not happen overnight, it doesn't happen over years.
No.
It can take a long time. So if you're interested, it's the long game. It's beyond a long game. And it almost never becomes your career.
Yeah.
I still have a day job, which I'm very thankful for. That gives me financing and benefits to do all the other stuff I want to do.
Yes. So my history in the genre is very similar to Alex's in that I was an academic studying sociology. And so I was interested in cultural production. I was interested in why we think the way we do and how media plays a role in that. And so that kind of got conjoined with my love of horror when it came to my thesis, which became a book that I brought RuMorgue on board to have a book launch party. The Black Museum lecture series and the Faculty of Horror were born out of that. And eventually, you know, I got into RuMorgue and I kind of climbed an invisible ladder. And so when you say that it's a super long game, I don't want to quash anyone's dream
No.
But there is absolutely no way in hell that I could have envisioned what it would become. And that's true of the podcast, and that's true of my career, that's true of everything. I just kept plowing away in the hopes that the right audience would catch. And it did in certain ways to the point that here I am. But it's not one of those things like so many goals in my life. You see it, you see the end game, and you take the steps to get there. Horror journalism is not at all like that. And my advice for anyone wanting to get into the industry is to just kind of really sit down and be honest and identify why you would want to be a horror journalist mm-hmm. and what it is that you hope to get out of it. Because especially now, as I am the editor of RuMorgue, again, I recognize that this is a crazy dream job. This is like I never, ever even thought that this would be a career path that was possible, much less the one I'm in disbelief every single day. But what I've noticed when I'm receiving pitches and when I'm putting together the magazine, there is a difference between the horror writer who is like Alex, who has a day job and a deep passion for horror and a great mind for horror. And when I assign Alex something to write, she pours her heart and soul into it, and that shows in the writing. However, when I receive pitches from, and I call them in my head, career writers, which is to say the freelance writer who does this for a living, and it's different because they treat it like a job. And that passion doesn't show. What does show is haggling over rates, haggling, like all the bullshit that I have to deal with as editor of RuMorgue. And let me say, again, this is totally a dream job, but the majority of my day is not spent writing on horror movies that I'm passionate about. That's a perk that I get every now and then. For the most part, I am stroking egos. I am wiping bums. I am doing all this admin things. I'm doing the best that I can, but it's really like, you know, it's spinning a lot of plates in the air, and there's a lot of, it's very, very stressful. So if you're looking to get into horror writing because you love it, then get yourself a day job and continue to love it. If you want to be a writer, then by all means, I'm not trying to quash anyone's dreams. Just know that the grind is really different and probably not what you're thinking it is.
And the industry is changing so much.
So much.
It's not like we're in, you know, the David Fincher film Zodiac, where we can all be like Robert Downey Jr. drinking who knows what and showing up to work and writing incredible pieces. But then you get fired and live on a boat, which is fine. But I just rewatched Zodiac. Can you tell? But the grind is real. The industry just isn't paying what it used to pay.
No.
And I don't. It's not that writers will ever become obsolete. It's not that journalists will ever become obsolete. It's that their role is shifting and we are in a period of transition.
Yes.
So it's, you know, if you're going for it, absolutely go for it. But my instinct is to say, play it safe. Because it's hard. It is really hard. And, you know, for, you know, wherever I am in my career, wherever you guys might think I am in my career, I pitch semi-regularly. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty lucky and I get offered a lot of work, mm-hmm. which is incredible, but I also pitch and never hear back.
Yeah.
Constantly. Constantly. It's always fingers crossed, you hope for the best, but you still don't hear back from a lot of people. And I actually think you brought up an interesting point, Andrea, and maybe we can talk a little bit about it, which is pitching. Pitching is something that comes up a lot, and it's something that seems kind of easy, and in some ways it is, But I don't mind sharing with you guys, and Andrew, you can absolutely weigh in, and please, as an editor, give your own tips and tricks. But what I always think about when I'm pitching is not only do you have to have the, you know, the W's, the who, what, where, when, why, and how, mm-hmm. plus the H, but you also have to have something that I have become really familiar with in my day job, which is in marketing. And when I write marketing copy, it's always the question of so what?
Yeah.
So what? So I want to write a piece about the Howling because it's blah, blah's thing, and it's this, and it's this, and it's some kind of anniversary. Who knows? So what? Mm-hmm. Why should this editor care? Why should their audience care? Mm-hmm. You have to make that point. And it's not necessarily a huge essay. You don't want to take up an editor's time with like a 5 to 2,000 word pitch. It's something succinct. And this is something I learned when I was in theater and I was working in directing classes and I was doing some work as a director. And it was everyone always said, you should be able to distill your essence of what you want in a play down to a sentence.
Yep.
So I'm directing a production of Hamlet, and this production of Hamlet is about the way the bourgeoisie eats itself. Uh-huh. That's my interpretation of Hamlet in this production, let's say. And you, as a writer, have to be able to distill why this piece is important. What are you going to say with it? And give a sense of how you're going to say it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely bang on. And I'll add that insofar as I'm in a position where I can offer some paid work to horror writers, I've got 6 issues a year. It's not a lot. I turn down so many pitches that I would love to see exist mm-hmm. that I can't fit into the magazine. So please, God, please, if you're pitching stuff and it's not catching, that is not to say that you shouldn't do it. You should do it. You should write it. You should start a blog. You should start a fucking podcast and get your voice out there. If there is one singular thing I can say that I did that got me where I am, it's this podcast you're listening to right now. I was able to prove to the president of RumOrg that I had ideas and I had passion and I was organized enough to execute them in a semi-regular fashion. So I think that's a really good point.
And I would say when you're if you're starting something, be really clear in your mission statement about what you're doing that no one else is doing. Be super clear. Or if you're doing something, you know, if you also want to do a feminist horror podcast, amazing, go do it. But just be clear about what you're bringing to the table that maybe doesn't already exist. Mm-hmm. Because if you're bringing, you know, something that is already out there, then why would I engage with it necessarily? And that's that was kind of the overriding thing when I wrote my 2 books. It was that those 2 books didn't exist.
That's right.
Had they existed, I would have happily bought them with the salary from my day job and read them and been like, what interesting facts.
Yeah.
So glad I read those. Thank you so much. But it was that feeling inside me that I was like, oh, those don't exist and mm-hmm. I want to read them and I'll just do it.
Yeah. And then on the heels of that frequently asked question was, what advice do you have for getting into writing and finding your voice as a writer? Which I think is a great question, a really interesting question. I think the pat answer that I will give that you will find everywhere is read a lot and write a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I really thought that I had honed my writing skills and my writing voice in post-secondary because I was writing so many essays. Until I discovered my childhood diary at my parents' house a couple of years ago, and I realized that I wrote in it semi-regularly throughout my high school life. And at that time, I sure as hell did not think of myself as a writer or that I wanted to be a writer, and I wasn't writing for anyone's eyes but my own. But when I go back and reread that, I was writing from the heart, and I got used to articulating my thoughts and my feelings, and that was probably the best training I got in my entire life. So write. Read.
Yeah. And you know, when you're pitching places for whatever it is, know what they do. Know what they do and how they do it.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to pitch to RumOrg, try to pick up an issue of RumOrg.
Try not to address it, Dear Fangoria, because Jesus, fuck.
Oh, that happens so much.
It happens more than I care to admit.
Or even a Dread Central or a Bloody Disgusting. Make sure you're reading those sites regularly and you kind of know
what
you're going for.
You're pitching everywhere. Just be careful. Do that due diligence because that'll get my back up so quick. Not because I'm a monster, but because I get so many of these.
And not because we hate Fangoria. It's just basic respect, guys.
That's all.
She's Andrea.
That's all.
She's fancy.
Say Dear Andrea. Actually, Dear Andrea, I Love the Faculty of Horror is probably the best lead you could have to a fucking pitch.
If you guys just want to write a fluff piece about us and Andrea, you just want to publish it in RumOrg, say go for it.
Okay.
Okay, second question, another much-asked question. How do you decide on what movies to do in the podcast, and what is the process of putting an episode together like?
Yeah. Well, it's very organic and very collaborative, I'd say. Alex and I are good friends, and we speak very regularly, and so something will just kind of come up and bite one of us, and, hey, you know what I'd love to talk about is blah. You know what I'd love to talk about is blah. I would say that that's maybe 80% of it.
Yeah.
And the other percent is when we're not quite sure. We look back on the year and, you know, we haven't done something international in a while. We haven't done something contemporary in a while. We haven't done something
classic.
Classic. Yeah, exactly. We just try to switch it up and add a lot of variety. But we do listen to your suggestions. Mm-hmm. We have a spreadsheet to keep us organized. And we're just trying to keep it as interesting and as varied as possible.
Yeah. And in terms of putting the episode together, we do our research pretty separately. Very rarely do we kind of share what each one of us is going to talk about before we sit down to do a podcast. Just because we've just evolved, our relationship as collaborators and as friends has evolved. And I'm just always excited to see what Andrea is going to bring to the table. So it's almost like I don't want to spoil it for myself. I want to react to it. I want to feel that in the moment.
That's right. But that said, sometimes I'm stumped and sometimes I'll be like, where are you taking this? And that'll kind of trigger something. And I know my take will be different even if we're looking at the same area and stuff. So it's very collaborative.
And then what are your likes and dislikes about a podcast?
Well, what I like about it, and this is something that's, again, been really amplified by being the editor of RumOrg, RumOrg has been around for 21 years now. It was started by somebody who had a very specific vision and a very specific void that they were hoping to fill in the horror journalism world. And I'm carrying that torch. I've been hired to lend my expertise and my perspective to that torch, but there is still a pre-existing history to this thing that I have to hold to, so to speak. You know, I don't know dick shit about horror music, and so I kind of trust my music editor to provide that to the reader. And I weigh in a little bit now and then, but for the most part, it's my job. When it comes to Faculty of Horror, that is my baby. We made that from the ground up.
Yep.
And insofar as we said before, like, have a clear vision of what it is you're trying to do. I think we had a vague vision and it just crystallized as we started doing it. And so.
And podcasts were really still in their kind of infancy in 2012.
Totally, absolutely.
So we had a bit of room to play and figure it out.
Mm-hmm. I definitely love the absolute editorial freedom. This is the while I can say whatever the fuck I want and not answer to anyone ever. Not that RumOrg really polices me, but it's just different when it's yours. And it's a very low cost and a high propensity for intimacy with our listeners. I think that being in your ears when you're doing housework or on your commute, it's an intimate thing. And the letters that we get from you are sometimes tear-inducing.
Yeah. Definitely, to echo Andrea's sentiment, the likes are getting to collaborate with one of my best friends and share a passion and figure this out together and have this relationship. But even more so, it's been the relationship with you guys and the things that's kind of brought into my life, the friendships, the opportunities, and just mainly hearing from you guys and that you enjoy it, that it means something to you. Because I know when I get a podcast in my app that I really love and it's on a day where I'm having a shit day and I just get to listen to this thing that I love, that means the world to me. So if we do that for you, that's incredibly humbling, and we take it very, very seriously. I mean, dislikes, it's you can never really turn off from it. I certainly always try to kind of track what's going on with our stuff. You guys are more than willing to hold us accountable to everything we say, and as you should.
As you should.
And we've certainly learned a lot from that, but it can be more than humbling sometimes, and even embarrassing others.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
Dude,
yeah.
Have you heard our first episode lately?
Nope.
You know, the podcast has grown so much, and I know people are still just discovering the podcast. And I think something that happens is because we dissect movies in a spoilery way, I think when people first discover the podcast, they don't necessarily go beginning to end. I think some of them do.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes people are just kind of like, oh, I really love this movie. Let's see what they have to say about this. And that'll be my benchmark of whether or not I get on board with this episode.
Makes sense.
But when I hear the early episodes,
I don't even want
cringe. And there's stuff that that I have changed my mind about. There's stuff I've been called out on that I've learned from and I wish I hadn't said. To my grave, I will regret the way I spoke to Alex in our Buffy episode. I would like to smite that episode from our repertoire, but I won't because it's part of our history and part of our thing. But there is an element of permanence.
Yeah.
And when we put this stuff out, you know, you don't get to – and it's that way with the magazine too. But with the magazine, again, I've got a team kind of wiping my ass for me.
Yeah, it's not like a kind of wrong-headed tweet that you can just kind of quietly delete.
No.
It's there. And we, you know, we still receive comments about certain things and – you know, we respond to those and we continue to respond to them. And that's a bit of a strange answer, but it's a bit of a strange topic.
Basically, the likes way outweigh
yes,
the dislikes, which is why we're still doing it and why I would recommend to anyone to do this. It's easy, man, and you learn as you go. If there are technical aspects to the podcast that interest you, let me know, because I've always kind of flirted with the idea of, separately from Faculty of Horror, maybe making a How to Make a Podcast something or other. But at the same time, there's so much out there that mm-hmm. wasn't out there when we first started that I don't even know what I could add to that. But
So our next question is, what books would you recommend for getting into horror academia?
My answer to that is actually that, again, going back to my own history, I started as a culture junkie, as a sociologist. And what I bring to the table for Faculty of Horror and for RoomWorg is that standpoint that I apply to horror movies. There's a lot of great academic books out there on horror movies, and we've listed them on our website.
Yes, we have, Andrea.
But I think my advice to you would be, what is it that fascinates you about horror? Mm. And research that independently of horror, and then bring it to horror, because it might not have been brought before.
Mm-hmm. Like Andrea said, we have a reading list on our website, facultyofhorror.com.
Link it.
We'll link it. Absolutely. And that's kind of a general thing. I actually just pulled down a bunch of books from my bookshelf mm-hmm. and listed them. And then I listed the books Andrea and I have written separate from those, things we've contributed to. So those could be a good place to start. But like Andrea says, like, you guys aren't me. I'm not you. You're not Andrea. It's you know, you find your thing.
Yeah.
Find that thing you're interested in. If you watched Halloween and you were fascinated by the way the police were portrayed in that film, research fucking law enforcement in film.
Criminology.
Criminology, all of those things. You know, find those things that interest you. Try to track them and then see where that leads you. You'll find a thematic commonality that'll lead you to something probably really interesting.
I agree.
And then we've got, what are your favorite horror fiction books and what are you currently reading?
I love that I can answer that now. I feel like I've been asked that over the years, and I've been like, I've got no time to read. I don't fucking know. Don't rub it in. My life sucks. Fact of the matter is, when I got a dog, I got into audiobooks because if there's one thing I hate in life, it's standing around, and walking a dog is a lot of standing around. So I downloaded a whole bunch of audiobooks, and I've been listening to audiobooks, and I've been chewing through horror fiction, finally getting caught up with that world through my dog. So a couple of highlights that I just discovered this past year. The Girl Next Door by Jack Ketchum. I was seeing this book appearing on lists of the most disturbing books of all time, and I absolutely see why.
Really?
Yes. So this book is, he's a Canadian writer, and I think he died last year? Was it the year before? I think he recently died, so I was reminded of him and his books recently, which is why I went back to The Girl Next Door, which is based on a true crime account of a mentally ill woman who was allowing a girl to be tormented under her watch. It's, man, the less I say, the better. It's very disturbing. It's fairly graphic, however, never gratuitously so. There is a lot of introspective discussion as to why young boys might be compelled to torture someone. Like, it sounds unbelievable, and yet they talk about the power differentials, how that happens, how that's different when a shirt is on or off. It's upsetting, and it's raw, but I'm so glad I read it. I think it's hugely important in horror fiction.
So for my kind of horror fiction, my fiance, Danny, he's a really big fan of Stephen King.
Uh-huh.
Always has been.
I love that about him.
Yeah. No. And when he gets really excited about something, he just talks so passionately about it. And it's like, ah.
So cute.
It's so cute.
So
God,
cute,
he could
Amy.
Be like the most handsome cult leader. But he was so hyping up the Stephen King kind of short story novella compilation, Different Seasons.
Mm.
And I read that this year.
Brilliant.
Loved it / was terrified by it,
mm-hmm.
At people in particular.
Okay.
Just, I feel weird about all of it in a good way, in a way that King intended me to feel weird about it, but also the breathing method, things like that, just some excellent writing. There's also the novella that Shawshank Redemption is based off of in there.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, for me as someone who's still kind of a King novice, that was a great way to get into it. So if you haven't read it or you want to try something Stephen King-y, Different Seasons.
Check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great starting point. I'd also like to mention Nick Cutter was a name that I see in the magazine a lot. He's just killing it with horror fiction lately. My favorite of his that I listened to this past year is a 2016 novel called The Troop, and it deals with a viral infection that has some kind of zombie-like traits on its victim, and when that infection reaches a troop of Boy Scouts on a remote island, it makes for a really interesting and fucked up Lord of the Flies-y situation. And I also really enjoyed The Deep. I've enjoyed most of what I've read from Nick Cutter, but The Troop really stood out for me.
The next book I'm reading, certainly right now anyway, I'm about halfway through, a little bit more than halfway through, is a book I got for Christmas, and its new book came out in 2018 called Wasteland, The Great War and the Origins of Modern Horror. And this
Ooh.
Is a nonfiction book. It's by W. Scott Poole, and it's basically, its thesis is that all modern horror, whether it be movies, books, video games, whatever, stems from World War I.
Dang.
Right?
Bold.
Bold and very interesting. I don't agree so far with all of it,
mm-hmm.
But it is very interesting. And if you're interested in the book, I would recommend trying to either pick it up or get it from your local library, because it's a pretty big release in 2018. And yeah, I'm very intrigued by it. It's really good because I feel like I have a solid knowledge of World War II, but World War I is a bit of a like general knowledge blank spot.
Yeah, well, I feel like it's less contentious.
Well, it's less, you know, like there's this big bad guy and he was a bad guy for these reasons.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, this book does a really good job of illustrating, you know, the effects of World War I and how it's created so many of the contemporary conflicts we are still dealing with today through land divides, through tensions between countries, things like that, and the kind of things that the art that came out of it and how that art is still influencing us today. I don't know if I agree with all of it, but it so far has been a very interesting read.
Cool. And then the last book / author I guess I'd like to highlight is Josh Mallerman. He is a Michigan-based writer that the books editor of Rue Morgue is very, very fond of. And so when she found out I was getting into audiobooks, she suggested several of his books, and I have chewed through several of them. And my favorite was Bird Box.
Mm.
And I think we all know Bird Box by now. Thanks.
I know the meme.
Oh my God, so many memes. And you know, it's one of those things that I think it hit the right platform at the right time. And I'm not trying to slag it. I definitely prefer the book to the movie for reasons I'll get into in a moment. But that movie is a hit. It's a bona fide horror hit. And when we're talking about horror in 2018, it wasn't on either of our best loved lists, but it was definitely a big deal.
I only watched 20 minutes of it.
You didn't finish it?
No.
The book is excellent. And what I liked about it, if you're not familiar, it is the story of a creature that emerges out of nowhere that if human eyes lay upon it, that human will go mad and either become suicidal or homicidal or both. They just go crazy. But it's undeveloped intentionally so, because it's mostly that kind of siege horror. It's mostly that kind of it comes at night type thing. And you know how we feel about female characters who are solely driven by motherhood. We've talked about this. We've argued about this.
And we love mothers.
We've argued with you about this. We've argued with each other about this. However, this film what I loved about the book is that this mother is in such an impossible situation that she has to be very cruel to her children in order to save her. And I thought that was the most interesting thing to happen to the trope of motherhood in horror that I've seen in a long-ass time. So on the heels of that, Josh Malerman has – that's a 2015 book that – yeah, there's audiobooks and ebooks, any way you want to check it out. But he's got a new one coming out. And I was lucky enough to get an advance galley for coverage in the magazine, and it's called Inspection, and it's very interesting. So look out for that. Josh Malerman.
Did you see A Quiet Place?
Did I see it?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Boring. Boring
right.
place.
Right. I just want to make sure because...
Again, like there was a couple of moments that if they did this, it would have reached me. If they did this, it would... It was a
They're
poor man's It Comes at Night.
Idiots.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, pull out. It's the fucking apocalypse.
Sorry, Jim. Should have stuck with Pam.
Next question. What trends are you seeing in horror? What do you hope continues or goes away? Moms in horror is a thing, right? Between Mother, Suspiria, Hereditary, is New American Extremity a thing? Who would you like to see working in horror who currently isn't? Yeah, I put those all together because it was a big, like, what is the current state of horror kind of... thing.
Yeah. And it's funny because I did an interview just today that asked me exactly that. And I was like, you know, this question, ask me in 10 years. Ask me in 10 years what 2019 was about in horror, because I will be able to look back, identify what hit big, what didn't, what resonated, what was happening. Hindsight is 2020. And I don't think it's reasonable to identify the most meaningful trends right now. I think we can look at box office and we can look at...
And I would say like we can see, we kind of pick out some stuff that's occurred since Jennifer Kent's The Babadook, maybe even Robert Eggers' The Witch, this kind of more quote-unquote adult horror. And people are kind of very concerned about this elevated horror thing and all of that. All that going to say, for me, semantics are not interesting.
No.
You call it whatever the fuck you want. I don't care. Make me scared. Entertain me. Thrill me.
Make me think.
That's what I want to see. Exactly. That's what I want to see. But to speak to that a little bit, you know, I see these people, it's just very reactionary. And they get very upset about it. And it's like, what do you think it was like when, you know, Rosemary's Baby came out, or The Exorcist came out, or The Shining came out? These are, you know, made by, you know, relatively big or up-and-coming, you know, artsy directors who were playing in the horror genre and really succeeded in these incredibly iconic films. They weren't Night of the Living Dead. They weren't Nightmare on Elm Street. They were these kind of big cultural moments. And I think that, you know, we've gotten this wave of adult horror. I think it will maybe continue for maybe another year or two, and then it'll probably peak down back into back down, I'm saying in quotes, because I love teen horror, into more teen horror stuff. And I think with the release of my new book, a lot of people were asking me about where teen horror is now. And I have to say, I think Blumhouse is killing it with that. And they are, you know, Blumhouse is like this full service horror enterprise. And I think that's amazing. And, you know, they're really doing well with stuff like Happy Death Day, and even with stuff like Truth or Dare, which I didn't love. But it's you're talking to a specific audience, and they're going to the cinema, or they're watching it with their friends, and they're having fun.
Yeah.
You know, so all of these things can exist. For me, one of the biggest horror trends actually has less to do with thematic elements and more of a couple of things we've alluded to already in this episode, which is release and distribution.
Okay.
In terms of things hitting VOD, in terms of things hitting streaming platforms.
Yes.
And that's not just horror. That is film in general. So think about it. We have right now on Netflix, Roma by Alfonso Cuarón, which is a very strong contender for Best Picture and Best Director, and I'm sure a couple other things at the Oscars this year. And it was just released on Netflix.
Yeah.
It was like, boom, it got a small theatrical release that Netflix was kind of playing with, and they just, it's on Netflix. You could watch it, right? You could pause this podcast, and if you have Netflix, watch it. That's incredible. Even the notion of what we were talking about earlier with Bandersnatch and all of these things, like these streaming platforms, Shudder, Amazon, Hulu, what have you, it's becoming a different way to consume film.
Yes.
And it's becoming a different way to reach people. And there's a lot of talk in the industry right now about the digital disruption. We are so inundated with so much content that we become overwhelmed by it, and that, you know, we can pick whatever.
Yeah.
I can just rewatch The Office for the fifth
time. It's a little bit numbing. Like, how often have you scrolled through Netflix mindlessly in the time it would have taken to watch something?
Yeah, it was interesting. Another film I really liked from this year, which isn't horror, even horror adjacent, I'd say, well, not really, is a film called First Reformed, which is written and directed by Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver, most notably, and stars Ethan Hawke in probably the best Ethan Hawke has ever been.
Better than The Purge?
Even The Purge. Not as good as Sinister. JK, like it's better than Sinister.
I like Sinister.
I like Sinister too, though.
Okay, okay.
But it's interesting because Paul Schrader is this, like, old fuck who was like, New Hollywood is going to make my life. And then, like, a few years ago, he was making a movie with Bret Easton Ellis and Lindsay Lohan. Respect Paul Schrader. But he was talking about how he feels like films are made and then marketed through algorithms.
Mm.
And I thought that was a very interesting idea, is the way Netflix kind of does not release any data or releases data very selectively. Mm-hmm. But it has all of our viewing habits. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's watching us.
Oh, yeah.
It has all of these things about us, and it's creating content because it knows what we like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and it doesn't give a fuck about press either. Mm-mm. Like when I was gunning for, Bird Box, like Netflix is commissioning original material and they don't want to talk to press because they don't fucking care.
They don't
Everyone's going to watch this. Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly. It doesn't even matter. The fact that they are commissioning original material, Amazon Studios, mm-hmm. Suspiria was an Amazon film. I saw something about a YouTube exclusive something
great.
Coming up. I can't remember what it was, so that's great.
But we're moving as an audience more towards streaming platforms.
For sure.
And I think with algorithms, metadata, all of that stuff that I need to use in my job as a marketer, my only concern with it is, as an audience member and as a film critic, is that it's really significantly narrowing our viewpoint.
Mm.
It's not like, oh, I'm just going to go to the cinema tonight and see what happens. It's like, oh, Netflix has all these picks for me, or I remember that, or mm-hmm. I can just put that on, and that's fine. So, you know, I'm worried we might get into a preaching to the choir kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
we can only wait and see.
Yeah. And I would say, actually, if you are interested in this and this kind of topic and learning more about the industry, one of the things that I've absolutely loved in 2018 and even a bit before that, podcast from TIFF, the International Film Festival, called TIFF Long Takes. Full disclosure, I've been a guest on it twice, but they have amazing interviews with really cool people in the industry, from like the guy who runs the membership at the Academy Awards to filmmakers, to activists, to all these kind of people. And they talk so in depth about the industry in such an accessible way.
Hmm.
So if you are interested in learning more about the industry as a whole and kind of what's coming up and current trends and things like that, we'll link TIFF Long Takes in the show notes and you should go follow them.
Cool. So trend-wise, I mean, like I said, I really do believe that trends are best identified within their context in retrospect. But I did mention earlier that I'm really excited about these movies that are embracing the impact of social media in our lives. I thought that was really fresh and exciting about Assassination Nation, as we talked about, and Cam, and then Searching. Have you seen Searching?
I have.
I cannot believe the extent to which that movie was able to tell a story with a desktop.
Mm.
And I'm talking about the first 5 minutes. The first 5 minutes, not only did I have a complete story, but I was in tears and I was able to go along with it. Nothing seemed contrived. Like, you know, you look for plot holes and stuff like that. And why would there be a camera there or something like that? But it pulled it off. I'd like to see that develop further.
And Unfriended Dark Web also did a good job of that last
year. It was okay. It wasn't as good as the first one.
They were different, but yeah. I enjoyed them. I enjoy them both.
I enjoy that medium, and I think there's
it's interesting.
It's not a gimmick. I think it's here to stay because there's
a lot. It fucking
should
be.
Yeah,
that's
there's
how
a
we live
lot
our
of
lives.
Storytelling to be mined out of that format. So filmmakers, don't be afraid. It's roll with it because it's hitting us because that's how we live our lives now, like it or not. And Black Mirror Bandersnatch, I mentioned before that it was something of a disappointment to me, but I am interested in that choose-your-own-adventure technology.
Mm-hmm.
I hope someone does something with it that really blows me away.
Yeah. I guess we also should investigate this kind of new American extremity question.
Okay.
Not that I wrote the book on New French Extremity, but I did write a book about New French Extremity. And what I will say is I think that's very nice. You want to say that about those films. I actually think the kind of current state of American filmmaking in terms of topic and subject matter is much more akin to kind of where we were in the late 60s through early 70s. Films like Rosemary's Baby and Night of the Living Dead, things like that, but even more progressive and more inclusive in some ways. But I think it's, you know, we've got kind of a pseudo-fascist government in power in America right now. Hopefully that will change by the time this episode comes out. And it won't. So I think there's already a kind of progressive change. What I will say about New French Extremity, and again, you can buy my book on Amazon, but New French Extremity came out of a film culture in France that never really had the kind of new Hollywood experience, this kind of like, fuck you to the major studio system, and we're going to go indie, and we're going to, you know, make Easy Rider and Last Picture Show and shit like that, and then go into horror through that route. They are a very dark culture, the French. And I don't think the American film market or the American filmmaker could ever tap anything as truly brutal as something like 29 Palms or Baisemois or Irreversible, things that I wouldn't consider horror films. But like, I remember the day I saw 29 Palms. Mm-hmm. And I am a different person after I saw that film, mm-hmm. because it was so fucking dark. And I, God bless the American optimism.
Maybe there's a trend happening, but it's not going to be like a trend that we know.
Yeah.
So, you know, stay tuned and stay vigilant. And that's, we're not trying to suck the fun out of anything. It's just, you don't want to be the first to be like, oh, this.
Yeah, I'm sure someone tried to call, like, the Saw films the new American Extremity or some shit like that.
Oh, well, I mean, torture porn.
Yeah, which a lot of New French Extremity horror gets lumped in with.
There you go.
Jinx. So, up next, what are your guilty pleasure / comfort horror films that you enjoy watching?
What a fun question.
Yeah, what's yours?
Well, I have a real soft spot for the bad Stephen King TV adaptations.
Yes.
I love them. I mean, I hold it a cut above. I really think that that's the best made-for-TV movie in existence. It scared the pants off me. It was reasonably faithful to the book, and it gave me all kinds of feels. But even the really bad ones, even the really bad version of The Shining,
love Storm of the Century.
Storm of the Century, yeah.
Oh, it's
Langoliers,
so stupid.
Tommyknockers, oh, Desperation, yes. The Stand, they're crap, but I love them.
Yeah, I totally agree with Andrea, but I think one of my favorite movies to watch and to show people and that I try to watch kind of once a year, well, it's kind of two films. One that went from a guilty pleasure to being an actual, like, full-on favorite is Pet Sematary 2. I fucking love that movie. Uh-huh. I think it's really interesting. It's really great. I find Anthony Edwards very sexy in that film. And then my other one is also featuring one of my favorite sexy men, and that is Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers.
Okay.
I fucking love that movie. It is so fucking crazy and so fucking stupid. I'll take a theatrical cut. I'll take a producer's cut. I don't care. Mm-hmm. It is bananas. It is a joy to watch. It is a joy to know that a group of adults sat down and agreed that, I don't know, what, $2-3 million was worth spending on this film. And they made all of these decisions. And fills me with so much fucking joy. I love it.
There you have it.
Question 6. Why, Andrea, is horror so therapeutic?
Well, that's a very personal question, I think. I think it's a question that I can answer only from my own experience. And even then, why is this movie therapeutic to me? Why is that movie therapeutic to me? They're going to be different answers. And I truly can't say that all horror is therapeutic.
I think, you know, there's a big stigma around processing trauma in our lives. It's like if you have trauma, if you've experienced terrible things happening to you, you hopefully have enough money to go to a therapist and things like that. But, just even when we were talking about Hereditary earlier in this episode, Andrea and I both saw reflections of our childhood in that film. And that felt, you know, even though I wasn't a huge fan of the film, it felt incredibly powerful in that moment. I think it gives a lot of light to a lot of the taboo subjects we're not supposed to talk about, that we're not expected to talk about, mm-hmm. You know, whether it be rape revenge, whether it just be death, whether it be mental health issues, all of these things that we are supposed to kind of scurry away with and like hide in the darkest parts of ourselves or uh-huh. go talk about to a medical professional. We can, you know, go pay a bit of money or go stream something on a service or even download it and engage with something we are not supposed to necessarily do on an everyday basis. And it can help process it. It can help make it, for at least ourselves, less stigmatized. Mm-hmm. It can give us a window into something else. Yeah.
And I think even if it's not trauma, even if it's something as simple as the apprehension I feel walking down the street mm-hmm. alone at night in Toronto, I wouldn't call that trauma, but I would call that an apprehension, a fear that I live with that I never see manifested in the real world except in horror. And when it's done well, it hits me in the feels because I can relate.
Yeah.
So maybe it's more cathartic than it is therapeutic, but that's up to you.
Yeah. Another question. Favorite movies outside the genre?
Okay. Should we go one for one?
Sure.
How many do you have?
I just got my two, but okay. I could go forever.
Well,
I love movies. I love movies. You start and we'll just fucking go. I'll just make
all
it
right.
up.
Okay. So I've mentioned Barbarella on this podcast before. I love that fucking film. It is so fun and light and colorful when it's not dark and bizarre and creepy. I love it.
I love a movie called The Red Shoes by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. It's from the late 40s, and it's brilliant and amazing. Martin Scorsese constantly refers to it as one of his favorite films, and for good reason. It is probably one of the best dance films.
Wow.
Ever.
You mentioned that one in our Peeping Tom episode.
Yeah,
right?
Because those directors went on to Michael Powell went on to go do Peeping Tom. Mm-hmm. And Moira Shearer, who's in Peeping Tom, is the lead in The Red Shoes. And it was on TV when I was little, and my parents taped it because my dad knew it was a good film. And I watched it, and it's beautiful and mm-hmm. devastating. It's about dance. It's about the pursuit of fame. It's about love. It's about intimate relationships. And fuck me, do I love it. It's one of the few films I went and sought out on Criterion.
No kidding.
Just because I love it so much and I just wanted – I don't have a lot of physical media, but I want to carry that movie with me.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ Superstar.
Wow.
This film, I mean, I don't know, we talked about Christianity in the podcast many times before. I was raised Christian and it was always so inaccessible. These stories were always so lofty and out of reach, and they could not relate to my life at all in any way until I saw Norman Jewison's rendition of Jesus Christ Superstar. And this was filmed and shot on location in Jerusalem. So the setting is amazing. It's very hippie. It's a very 60s rock opera. So it's funky as all fuck. But the way they position Judas, his relationship to Jesus, Mary's relationship to Jesus, it made it so accessible that I was like, holy shit, there's actually value in these stories after all. It's beautiful.
Hmm. One of my other like favorite films that I always kind of consistently mention is Tony Scott's True Romance.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I just think like there's not a film that's like sexier, funnier, or more violent. Mm-hmm. And I just love the characters, like the characters across the board. And it's got, I mean, the scene between Dennis Hopper and Christopher Walken.
I cannot hear that song the same way again.
Oh, it's so fucking good.
It is good. The costumes are great. I just love
like
the aesthetic.
Everything. Like it's everything
very Americana,
about
very
that
kitschy.
Film, it just sparkles.
Like a really good John Waters film.
Yeah.
David Lynch's Dune.
Mm.
I will defend this piece of shit until the end of the earth. He even hates it. But I really, really love it. And the film has huge holes. It has special effects that stand up and special effects that don't stand up. But I just really, really love it. Mm-hmm. It's on Netflix right now. And to my delight, I realized that the version that I had seen and fallen in love with was some cut. And there was a different cut on Netflix. So when I watched it again this past year, it was actually gorier.
Wow.
So I think you can imagine my orgasm at discovering that.
Oh, my.
Mm-hmm. Flood in my basement.
So another one I'll mention off the now top of my head is A Fish Called Wanda.
Oh, yeah.
It is a delightful British with a little bit of American comedy. It has Jamie Lee Curtis in it for all our horror fans. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that I just want to call out. Like, when people are like, ah, oh, Jamie Lee Curtis, she's so fucking good in Halloween. Yeah, she's great in Halloween. She's good in everything.
Everything.
Everything. Oh, my God. She's such a talented comedic actress.
Yeah, she can do fucking Freaky Friday and make it good.
Yeah. So anyway, if you haven't seen A Fish Called Wanda, it's with Michael Palin and John Cleese from Monty Python. So that was also something I grew up on. And then Kevin Kline, who I love, and Jamie Lee Curtis, who I adore. It's just a crazy madcapper comedy that I love.
Yeah, it's a good one. Okay, well, the last one I'll mention for outside the genre is a film that I come back to, and it's kind of like a palate cleanser for me, but also a tremendous downer. I might even, if you caught me on the right day, make an argument for it being a horror movie, and that is Closer.
Oh.
That movie takes my heart and stomps it into the ground. And that is, for me, a very accessible parable of, you know, a love quadriangle where people are shit. And when it comes to relationships in Western culture, you know, it's love and war, right? The heart wants what the heart wants. And I feel like this film really takes that ideology to really dark places where people just tear each other to shreds. And the way it all plays out, I can't say it's a feel-good film, but it's one that I come back to again and again, and I get something out of every time.
Mm. And I'll do one more. This is also going to be a British comedy. Sorry. Remember how I told you guys I was raised by a Brit? Well, here we are. It's a film called With Nail and I. And it is, you're looking at me like you haven't seen it.
Of course not.
Oh, my God.
I've never even heard of it. Like,
I'm going to sit on you and make you watch it. It is this tragic comedy, but it is so fucking dry and funny about these two out-of-work actors in London in the 60s. It was made in the 80s. And they, quote-unquote, go on holiday by mistake to the British countryside. And it all goes awry.
Is that a quote-unquote?
It is. We've gone on holiday by mistake. It's a very quotable film, Andrea.
It's very British by the sound of it.
Yeah, it's brilliant and funny and sad. And they're both like horrible alcoholics and it's all just kind of falling apart around them. It's kind of brilliant. I love that movie.
Nice.
Yep.
Well, there you have it, guys. If we made a non-horror podcast together, that's the kind of shit we would subject you to.
Yeah.
Let us know if you'd listen. Because maybe we'd do it.
Now, another question is, what horror films have traumatized you or given you nightmares? Is there something in horror that always scares you?
I don't know about you, Alex, but the horror movies that give me literal nightmares often surprise me. Mm-hmm. They're often not the ones that actually scared me as I was watching them. They just stayed with me for some reason that I can't – or even movies that I especially like.
Yeah, I mean – my nightmares are so malformed, but the thing that always scares me in horror films is kind of distorted female figure.
Mm. Oh,
whether
yeah.
that be like Zelda in Pet Sematary. Yeah. I had a very traumatic experience when I went to see that, I think it was the 2012 or 2013 version of The Woman in Black.
Mm.
I went to see that alone in theaters. I was fucking terrified. I was losing my fucking mind in like a midday afternoon, like Monday screening.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
losing my shit over this film.
And did you have nightmares?
I was very scared. I made my boyfriend at the time like come over to my house that night.
But did you have nightmares?
I can't remember if I have nightmares. I definitely like woke up jarred.
Okay.
And then, you know, something like, well, if I said what it is, it would kind of give away some stuff. But, you know, distorted female figures, you know, so something like The Grudge or The Ring, those tend to freak me out. I don't know what it is. It just,
So in terms of specific things that I watched and then had a nightmare after, I had – not only did I have a nightmare after watching that documentary, The Nightmare, but I had a sleep terror.
Oh, fun.
Which – it was fun and it was fascinating to me because I was like, holy shit, like this phenomenon is suggestible and that is so interesting. I wish someone would make a documentary actually talking about the science of that and not this shitty dramatization.
Legit, that is what a dear friend of mine said because he had sleep paralysis for a six-month period in his life. And it ended and he's very thankful it seems to have ended completely and he went to see The Nightmare hoping it would provide answers.
No answers. Not only no nightmares – but sleep terrors.
Yeah.
Fuck my life. I also had one of those weird compound nightmares after The Haunting of Hill House, which, you know, I know people really loved it and there were elements and moments about it that I really loved, but mostly it was pretty, I don't know, mediocre.
You know what I love? I love the boldness of Mike Flanagan to remake Oculus.
Yeah,
and I'm very excited to see what he does with Dr. Sleep.
I think he'll feed it poison and then bring it back to life with an EpiPen or whatever the fucking weird pseudoscience went on there. But I just have to say that after watching several episodes that night, I had a nightmare. And in my nightmare, I woke up next to Dustin and had another nightmare. And I woke up again. It was one of those. Like, so I can't even say that it's that show was especially scary. But dreams are weird and they hit you in the subconscious. And in terms of iconic scenes that consistently chill me, that title would have to go to the weird dog man thing in Kubrick's The Shining.
Ah.
It's the teeniest little blip in that movie. In that movie where so many scary things happen, that's actually a fairly nonsensical moment in the movie universe. In the book, that dog man has a bit more of a backstory and a thing. But that cut that closes in on that makes my blood run cold any time of day, any day of the year.
What was the first horror film you saw? What horror film was your gateway into the genre?
This question makes me grumpy.
Does it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I get asked this question all the time, and every time I answer it, invariably someone's like, that's not a horror movie.
Ugh.
Which not only does it invalidate my own experience, but it calls all this gatekeeping of the boundaries of horror into question that I resent with every fiber of my being. It was Terminator 2, guys.
That was scary. I was scared by
whether
that.
Whether or not you find that in the horror section of your local whatever the fuck, that is a scary goddamn movie, and it's also a very conceptual horror movie. It's very rich on ideas, and it blew my then 8 or 9 year old fucking mind.
So the first horror film I saw, and I saw this one in theaters, so that's kind of why I remember it. Like, I actually worked with my parents to kind of trace it back. Because I kind of grown up on like Tim Burton stuff. And,
okay, yeah, yeah.
And all that like weird macabre stuff.
Spooky and ooky.
Yeah. Like Shop Till You Freak at the Spooky Boutique.
You know.
And, but the first one I kind of saw in theaters, which is also a little bit of a cheat maybe, is Army of Darkness.
Total horror movie.
But like horror comedy. But yeah. I was like, I always had in my head that like my older brother, who's much older, he's 19 years older than me, wanted to go see it, and somehow I got dragged along. And I wound up asking my brother Giles, like, yeah, we went to see it in the theaters, right? You, me, and Dad. And Giles was like, yeah, you wanted to see it. You dragged us to see it. And so it was, oh, God, was it 92? 92, 93, 94. Oh, God. Someone's going to yell at me, I'm sure. But I was kind of around 7, 8, 9.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going to see it.
How the fuck did you get in?
It was because we were living in Montreal at the time, and the French do not give a flying fuck.
De pas de fucks
about who goes to see what at any time. So, and I remember seeing it at the Alexis Neon Odeon Plaza Mall Cinema.
Shit.
And I remember going to see it, and I just remember it was just like, oh my God, this is what this can be.
That's a pretty out there one. Like the stop motion, the
comedy, Bruce Campbell's chin.
Dang.
And like, and it didn't make any sense because like, obviously I had no idea about the Evil Dead films. My, you know, 40 something year old father had no idea. My brother didn't.
Yeah.
So we only stumbled upon later. Like, I remember years later, I might have mentioned this in our Evil Dead episode. My dad being like, oh, remember that movie you really liked? There are more. And so that's kind of how I got into the Evil Dead franchise and why I still love it. But I have this super clear memory of being vaguely attracted to Bruce Campbell as a 7 year old.
Early heterosexual stance.
Yeah. But I think truly the horror film that was my gateway into horror was probably Scream.
Mm-hmm.
It did a really great job of, you know, just talking about what you were talking about with gatekeeping. It kind of broke all that down.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, this is what horror films are. This is how they can be. These are the tropes, and fuck those tropes. We're going to blow them out of the water.
It's true. Yeah.
And it was great because I, you know, as I mentioned, I have older siblings. They're half siblings from my dad's first marriage. But I didn't have a lot of close siblings or people who were into horror around my age, but I loved it.
Yeah.
So I didn't I didn't know what to look for. So that was the film that was
that
like
plays such
Halloween.
A big role.
It does. And like Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Prom Night. And so then I was like, oh, I love this movie. So now I'm going to venture down into like the horror section of the video store and look for
By
these
yourself,
movies.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had the same experience.
That movie kind of gave me the key to so many other horror films.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can watch it to this day and think it's beat by beat a brilliant film. Mm-hmm. And I just personally know how much it gave me. And that's why I kind of wrote a book centered around it.
Yeah. That's us. But I think what we're illustrating here is how personal that moment and that context, and it has to do with your history and your expectations and where you were and who you were at the time. And it's different for everyone. But I love that someone asked us that. It's fun. It's fun to share.
So our last question, what genre character best represents your pets?
Genre character. Until they make a horror movie about Pokemon, I put Gizmo from Gremlins.
Aww.
You see it?
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty fucking cute.
Yeah. He is supernaturally cute.
He is.
It's disgusting. Like, I ate a bunch of mushrooms on New Year's Eve last year, and I was nervous to come home and lay eyes on him. I was like, I'm not going to be able to take it.
So because cats have more personality, I picked out some actual characters for my cats. Mm-hmm. Moon, who was the first cat Danny and I got kind of end of December, just over a year ago, I would have normally said she's like the dumb slut who gets murdered early on in a horror film. Mm-hmm. But right now, I'm going to give her the title of Patty from the Canadian horror slasher classic Curtains. Mm. Because Moon brutally murdered a mouse the other day. Mm-hmm. We live in an old house, so it's bound to happen every so often, especially as it gets really cold, as it is right now in Toronto. And Danny was home, and he had to deal with cleaning up mouse guts. And Moon then was just like, meow, 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 meow. And she's very beautiful and very cute and quite young. Like, she's a young 2-year-old cat. And then for my other cat, Church, who we got in like March 2018, and there was a question in the Faculty of Horror stuff from someone who follows me on Instagram asking, you know, if Alex is an agnostic, why did she name her cat Church? And we named her Church. We tried a couple names with her, and Church just really stuck, and it's after the cat in Pet Sematary.
Yeah.
And the
zombie cat.
Yeah. In Pet Sematary, Church is a male cat, and Church is a lady. And she's a senior cat, and she has so much character, and I feel like, oh God, I love her so much.
But she looks like she's been buried and came back to life.
Yeah, she looks like she's maybe on her 7th or 8th life.
Mm-hmm.
She was found on the streets, and the tips of her ears are missing due to frostbite from when she was found on the streets. But so she's a little temperamental, but with me, she's just like the biggest sweetie bum cutest ever, and I love her so much. So for that, I'm going to call her a more senior in her age or in her character development, Laurie Strode. And I would take a Laurie Strode from Halloween H2O or Halloween 2018, where she's like been through some shit.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to process it, and mm-hmm. she's going to drink a ridiculous amount of wine at a restaurant.
Okay. Wow.
That's my churchy. Sure. Follow me on Instagram @scare_Alex for more cat photos.
I don't think that was a frequently asked question, was it? That was one person, and you were like, I want to talk about how my cat is Jamie Lee Curtis.
She's so cute.
She's so cute. There you have it, guys.
Boo-boo.
There you have it.
You know, and I think this film is incredibly... Sorry. Oh, it's a sad wine burp. Not a hearty beer burp.
This film is very much situated in... You elaborated on that when you hosted a screening of the Faculty at the TIFF Bell Lightbox last week. No, not at all last week.
Last month. This film, even though it doesn't directly pull from it, is really indebted to Jack Finney's novel from the 1950s, The Body Snapshot. The Snapshots.
I had to take that chip out of my mouth when you started. Did you see that?
No, I didn't. I'm sorry.
I laid it on my tongue and you started talking and I just took it off.
Okay. In talking about the oddness and,
Oh, you dick. You're a dick dog. That rumor was so pervasive.
So pervasive.
And I bought it hook, line, and stinker. Yeah, I'll take a little sploosh. Glug, 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 glug. Does it lead into what you have to say about kale?
Mmm, kale. Mmm, chips. This is the anti-kale.
I read that there were deviations from the script, there were rewrites.
Before we go to the ending, can I talk a little bit about photography?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I was segueing. Can I eat a chip, though?
Yeah.
Can I eat two?
Yeah.
One and a half. Two little ones.
Surveilling the City, Whiteness, the Black Man, and Democratic Totalitarianism. And it is by a white guy named John Fiske.
Hang on, sorry. You said totalitarianism.
So...
Hang on. Let me eat some chips.
There's a mislead with Art, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, is his name Art or is he an art dealer?
He's an art dealer.
His name is Jim. We're seeing all this through Chris's eyes, that when he meets Art, Art is blind.
Jim?
Art, fuck! That's your homework for December, so until next time.
Decemberson?
Did I say that
right? And it's a quote from Roger Ebert, which is essentially, films are not what they're about.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. Films are not what they are about. They are about...
sorry.
I studied it towards the end of the... This nog is making my burp. Now, one of the other influences I had heard Aronofsky mention it...
Oh my god, you did get
you
through the door.
The door!
Did you just develop opposable thumbs? Kathy, look at him. He's so happy to be bad. Look what I did, Mom!
Oh my god!
Give me an outtake. It's almost the end of the year. Speak! Speak! Hello?
Especially because of the conflation of Mother the character and Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this nog is giving me, like, light burps.
I'm not holding my breath.
You might have to in a couple years.
We're just going to go to Mars. Grow three tits.
Hot.
I'm halfway
there. I can't even grow two.
Dante, be you quiet. Be quiet right now. Can you hear me? You sit.
For the listeners at home, he's two doors away from us.
He's freaking out. He's got me at home with him all day. What a spoiled child.
You sound just like a real mom.
Me?
Being like, you spoiled brat.
You have me all day. I just want a couple hours to myself.
I have them all day, Walter. Sing a song. Figure it out. You went to fucking law school, you dick.
Hi, everyone.
No. Don't be a bad boy. No. Okay, all right. That's
no, he's going to try one more time.
Okay.
I feel good about this. Okay.
It's just all this time that we're talking, he's not barking. It's only when we're recordy talking. It's like he knows.
When we're recordy talking?
Yeah.
Hi, everyone.
Oh, you little son of a bitch.
This is good.
Okay.
Dante, I was trying to give you the benefit of the doubt.
Really good.
I was on your side, bud. There's a lot of good performances in that film, but Dylan McDermott just blew me away. Oh, bleh.
Wow.
Bleh. Dylan McDermott blew up my mouth.
That sounds tasty.
It's directed by Nicholas...
Don't you start. All right, we're back.
And welcome to the inaugural round of Solve That Horror Movie Plot Hole.
This was Alex's idea, and she pitched it to me like a week ago, and I was like, okay, well, yeah, I don't know, maybe. But then, my life got crazy, I got busy, and I didn't prepare anything, but she did. So it's going to be kind of a one-sided quiz show where I am the contestant, and she is the Alex Trebek West.
Excellent.
Minus the mustache.
So... first question, Andrea, and all this is, I'm going to point out a plot hole to her, and she is going to have to, off the top of her head, solve it for me.
Right. And perhaps our listeners can be the scorekeepers.
Yeah,
let
sure,
me
that
know
makes
if
sense.
I succeed or not. I don't know.
I'll definitely want to keep tally of that.
Okay.
First question.
Yeah.
In Alien.
Okay.
Why didn't Weyland-Yutani invest in a robot crew from the beginning?
Invest in a robot crew from the beginning. Okay. So Bishop was a robot and he was a
Ash was a robot.
Fuck, that's what I meant. I'm already fucking this up. Ash was a robot and he was pretty sophisticated and... But, you know, his big failing was in his lack of humanity.
But wouldn't have that been better for the corporation?
Would it have been better for the corporation? It would have saved them money on salaries and benefits. That's for goddamn sure. But, you know, I think this kind of goes back to something run only by robots can go all kinds of wrong. And why didn't they? So that we could have a wonderful, scary movie.
Oh, pfft.
No.
I like to think of it as Weyland-Yutani is such a big corporation mm-hmm. that they knew that they needed human faces to kind of launch all their explorations into space. So they need the humans to create a kind of palatable public brand face.
Okay. Plot hole explained.
In The Thing.
Okay.
Why did MacReady, Gary, and Nulls split up to plant explosives knowing the thing attacks when you're alone?
Because they're men.
I'll take that.
Well, truthfully, divide and conquer does often seem like the economical forthright approach. And I even find that in regular task management. It's you do this and you do that and you do that, even if things are better tackled as a team. So, you know, can't hold that against them. They didn't know they were in a horror movie.
Or was MacReady already the thing?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
No.
Okay. This is kind of a specific one for you.
Shit. I mean, yay.
Why... In Night of the Living Dead,
okay,
is the upstairs of the house where they barricade themselves in not considered as a barrier area? They consider the first floor of the house and the basement. That's where the argument comes in.
Right.
But what about the top of the house?
You're talking about like the upstairs, upstairs floor? Barbara identifies that early as a bad, 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 can't go up there because there is a corpse up there that frightens her. And they cover that up. And after that point, the upstairs kind of becomes off limits. Practically speaking, I think the upstairs would have been subject to the same criticisms as going into the basement, in that if you become barricaded up there, you can't exactly jump out the window and be okay. Yeah, I don't know. I think that was just... more interesting cinematically.
All right. In Halloween 3,
shit,
how did Silver Shamrock's plot work against different time zones?
It didn't. They were not concerned with non-Western time zones because who cares about anything but America?
But so they only wanted to hit like California and the West Coast.
Oh, right. Even within America. There's a couple of time zones in there. Well, yeah, I stand by it. Merca.
And also, my answer would be pre-internet.
Pre-internet?
Yeah. No one would have been able to get it out. They'd all been dead.
All right.
Okay. This one might be contentious. I don't know about this, but we're going to go with it. In Pet Sematary, the original.
Okay.
Gage is barely talking when he's alive.
Uh-huh.
Yet when he's reanimated, he's quite verbal.
Uh-huh.
Why?
Because the demon's quite verbal. I mean, right? Like, don't you consider the ability to speak and communicate to be less of a, this is what I'm capable of physically as a, this is what I'm capable of cognitively type thing? I mean, isn't that even true of The Exorcist? Like, the stuff that Reagan was not capable of saying because it was so filthy and vile?
That is excellent because it brings me into another question.
Oh, boy.
Why, in The Exorcist, does Reagan / Pazuzu react to the tap water?
Well, I mean, tap water is only holy by a blessing, which is arguably arbitrary, but that arbitrariness becomes meaningful in the context of religion.
But why would the demon react to it when he's like, oh, it's just tap water?
Well, I mean, doesn't Father Karras identify other holes in Reagan's possession in terms of...
I'm asking about the tap water, Andrea.
But, like, it factors into the languages he spoke, Remember? Like, he was able to parlez-vous français, but he wasn't able to...
La plume de la tante.
Exactly. So yeah, no, I think it's... He was playing it up. He was playing the game.
Okay. So my final plot hole. So you better have a fucking
good
answer.
This is the worst. I feel like I'm going to lose my job.
You better have a fucking good answer to this one. Why,
yeah,
in the Hellraiser series,
yeah,
is the lament configuration so easy to solve?
Is it easy to solve?
Oh, pff. Most people who get it into their fucking hands are like, bloop, 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 and it fucking opens and the Cenobites show up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess it wants to be solved on a certain level. That would actually be a really interesting Hellraiser movie, as if there was a whole group of people who were desperate to solve it and couldn't, and then maybe there was a chosen one who came, and then you could make the argument that the Cenobites wanted that person above all other people. Because I do feel that the Cenobites are a bit selective, right?
Yeah.
In terms of their prey, they're just like, ah, you know, I guess Frank really deserved it. He really fucked us over. Whereas with Kirsty, we'll negotiate a little bit, betray her sort of, but, you know, like, it's not like they kept chasing her.
Ugh, but it gets real murky in those sequels.
Oh, God, it sure does. Yeah. Well, did I win?
Yes, you did. Congratulations. You won the inaugural round of Solve a Plot Hole with Andrea.
Oh, those are great questions, and, you know, that was fun.
All right, that is it for our 2018 assessment in January 2019. This has been really fun.
Yeah,
it's a good time of year to take stock, to think about what happened the year before, to answer some questions, to play a game.
It's been a great year for the podcast. Mm-hmm. I've been really thrilled with our work with Twisted Tees.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, offering our t-shirts available for sale a little bit longer, still limited time, but there's nothing easier than a print to order model. And so we're very grateful to Twisted Tees for offering us that. It's working out so well.
Yeah. And a big thank you to Stacey Ponder for designing the 2018 t-shirts. And I do really want to give a shout out to her and her new podcast, new-ish podcast. Mm-hmm. It's been around for a couple months now. It's a podcast she does with Anthony Hudson, and it's called The Gaylords of Horror. And it is excellent. It is really funny. It is really smart. It helps that I agree with like 95% of their opinions. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking for something else to get into, I would definitely give that a shot because it's really fun.
Right on. And next year we will have a new t-shirt available at some point. Keep listening.
Yeah.
We'll let you know when that's going to be available. But thank you so much for supporting us, even those who donate to us outside of our t-shirt drives. We're so, so grateful. It lets us do fun things like travel to Salem.
And you know, maybe just if you're not already following Salem Horror Fest on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, you know, maybe follow them for any kind of future updates for the 2019 festival that you guys might be specifically interested in.
Who knows? Who knows what rad chicks they'll invite back?
But it's an excellent horror fest. We went back for our second year and it was so much fun.
Better and better every year. Yeah. Kevin Lynch is a powerhouse and
he's the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you aren't able for whatever reason to pick up a t-shirt or donate monthly, that is beyond not a problem. But if you do have a little bit of time, consider leaving us a review or a rating on iTunes. That really does help the podcast and help fuck with the algorithms that Steve Jobs creates from the grave.
Oh, podcasts are growing and growing and growing. And I listen to some tech radio shows about what's happening, and there's always talk about iTunes possibly monetizing their stuff going forward and this and this and that. Faculty of Horror will always be free to listen to. Yep. We're very grateful for your generous donations and whatnot, and, you know, we're not doing it for the stats.
No. No. But we do have a really fun episode coming up next month.
Yes.
And so next month is February, which is Women in Horror Month.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought we'd embrace that a little bit. And we've decided to do a film that has been mentioned to us a few times, something we've talked a bit about between the two of us, and that is Ravenous.
Great film.
Great film. I'm very excited to revisit it.
Very unique film. I love period horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, this one's really cool.
Yeah, so that's your homework for next month. Check out Ravenous, Antonia Bird's Ravenous. And until next time,
office hours are closed.
They told us we were girls, and we talked, just look and cry. They told us we were girls, so we claimed our female lives. Now they tell us we are girls.